Worried about paying the rent or the mortgage this month? You're not alone. Good Monday morning. We are live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the looming housing crisis in Florida as unemployment benefits are soon set to expire. Is that you? Give us a call. Let us know how you're doing. It's 549-2937. Then later, how home health agencies are feeling the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic. But first this hour, here are the latest numbers on the COVID crisis. Statewide, we are reporting via the Department of Health 423,855 cases of COVID. That's a one-day increase of nearly 9,400. The death toll at the state level is 5,854 deaths, 230 deaths reported in our area. Now, in a moment, we're going to take a look at the latest on unemployment in our area, the potential expiration of benefits, and how that's affecting housing for millions of Americans. But first, Mayor Lenny Curry is expected to speak with local reporters this week about the cancellation of the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville. Last week, the president canceled the local component of the RNC, taking many here by surprise. Duval GOP Chairman Dean Black is on the line now with a look at his reaction. Dean, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And let me ask you, several of the host committee members for the RNC in Jacksonville, including Congressman Rutherford and the mayor, praised the president in pulling the plug on the RNC here, saying it was the right decision. If they believed that, critics of this move are saying, why didn't they publicly call for it to be canceled previously, given our high coronavirus numbers?
Ultimately, it was the president's decision to make, Melissa. We've said all along that Republican leaders were, while aspiring to greatness for our city by hosting this convention, were going to make sure that the public was kept safe above all else. And I think, frankly, that the president was erring on the side of caution. I don't think at the end of the day he was willing to take the risk. And he made the decision that he did, and we respect his decision.
We're hearing that no taxpayer funds were ever spent on the RNC, although there will be a local accounting of man hours spent at the city level. Small businesses also, and even some larger ones, have expressed frustration with the last-minute cancellation. You know, as just one example, downtown hotels had reserved room blocks for all of the delegates and attendees. They've lost those bookings and they had canceled other bookings. And so what's your message for the business community that had planned around this and are now seeing more losses?
Well, this is all about the virus, Melissa. COVID-19 has been a worldwide tragedy. And one of the latest casualties was our ability to follow through and host the convention here in Jacksonville. Those hotels and small businesses were suffering before we ever tried to do the convention, and it was hoped that we would be able to bring a tremendous economic impact here for their benefit. In the end, though, the proliferation of the virus made that impossible.
Right. And given that, it is striking to note the difference between the two major parties and how they plan their conventions. The Democrats have planned for a virtual convention in Milwaukee almost from the beginning. Back in March, they were putting together virtual convention planning. The Republicans, at the direction of the president, wanted an in-person convention with, in the beginning at least, with no masks, no social distancing. When Charlotte, North Carolina wouldn't agree to that, everything moved down here to Jacksonville. In the end, the president was looking at an event that would have been almost identical to what he could have staged in Charlotte. What about that?
Well, I think you've asked a couple of questions there. There is a fundamental difference between Democrats and Republicans. Look, the Democrats, they're in no hurry to bring forth their nominee. They would prefer that he hide in his basement, and I think this provides a convenient reason and ability for them to do that. But there's a fundamental difference, and that is that Republicans are trying to figure out how we can live during this age of pandemic. The truth is, we simply cannot shut everything down. If we shut everything down, if we all crawl under a rock, eventually the pandemic would cause a famine that would kill far more people than the pandemic itself ever would. And we simply can't do that. And that's a fundamental difference between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans are going to push on. We are going to be responsible about it, but we are going to figure out how to live and how to function as a society.
Where does the local party go from here in terms of mobilizing voters in this time of pandemic?
Well, we have taken in thousands and thousands of volunteers in the lead up to the RNC convention, and those people are already at work working to reelect President Trump here in North Florida.
All right, I want to thank you for your time this morning. He's Dean Black, chairman of the Duval County GOP. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right, we're going to shift gears now because more than 32 million people collected an extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits at the end of June as part of the federal stimulus program. Now, those payments were helping to keep missed rent payments only slightly higher than last year. But these benefits are set to expire soon unless Congress takes action, as are eviction moratoriums in many parts of the country. And that could cause a really extreme wave of housing insecurity. What does this mean for Florida? Jeff Tucker is an economist at Zillow. We've all looked at that website, right? And he's on the line with the latest numbers. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. Let's bring the numbers first to Jacksonville. You've crunched the data in our area. Losing the weekly $600 benefit could cause some real pain in this metropolitan area. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so we took a look especially at unemployed workers in high-contact occupations and industries. So those are your food and beverage serving workers, health technologists and technicians, people who are especially at risk of being laid off in a pandemic and who might be at risk for their health if they go back to work. So for those workers in particular, we tried to figure out how many would be extremely cost burdened on their rent, meaning they would pay more than half their income on rent while unemployed. Right now, with this extra $600 a week, that's pretty much solving the problem. Only 2% of people are extremely cost burdened right as, you know, as of this week. As of next week, when these benefits expire in the Jacksonville area, it'd be 51% of people would be paying more than half their income on rent in that category. So this would really hammer the budgets of unemployed people, and that is millions of people who'd have a lot of trouble actually paying their rent.
And this is particularly an acute problem for renters rather than those paying mortgages, is that right?
Yes, that is right. For one thing, homeowners tend to have higher incomes. They tend to have more savings as well. So the similar numbers suggest that without this boosted unemployment, about a quarter of mortgage payers in the Jacksonville area would become severely housing cost burdened.
We'll go to your calls in a moment as we speak with Jeff Tucker, economist at Zillow. Are you worried about paying your rent, your mortgage, if you lose unemployment benefits soon? We want your calls now. It's 549-2937. And so you also find that African-American households, Jeff, are even more affected in this area. Can you share a little bit more about what your research shows?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the situation there is that for folks working in these high-contact jobs, often, frankly, in white families, often that sort of high-contact job is sort of supplemental income or sort of maybe about half of the household income. But we found that for black households, when someone's working in one of these high-contact and therefore kind of high-risk occupations, their income is about 90% of household income. So especially in the Jacksonville area, it's still the large majority nationwide. So that suggests, too, that for black households, they're really sort of between a rock and a hard place if they're facing the expiration of unemployment benefits on the one hand or going back to a potentially really risky job situation on the other hand. Whereas it seems that for a lot of white households, they may be able to sort of have one worker stay home and still kind of muddle through on the other worker's income.
This is a real crisis, and it is set to become exponentially worse soon if Congress doesn't act. Here is a tweet from John. I challenge everyone facing financial jeopardy this week to lobby the Senate to pass the HEROES Act. How much of a difference would it make, Jeff, if the Senate got its act together, because they've been accused of a lot of foot dragging in this space, and passed a package to provide more relief to millions of Americans out of work and at risk of being homeless?
Well, it would make a huge difference. It would make a huge difference, especially to renters and homeowners who are laid off in these industries. One way of looking at it, actually, is we considered, okay, what if as a compromise, we just extend half the benefits? That seems like a simple scenario halfway between doing nothing and the current level of benefits. That still makes a huge difference. Nationwide, that would leave only 14% of these renters extremely cost burdened. In the Jacksonville area, it would leave only 20%, rather than over half of these unemployed renters extremely cost burdened. So that struck us as one sort of measure of just how, even just half the current benefit levels would make a huge difference.
Would make a difference. Here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page from William. I am jobless and homeless already. It is a terrifying time to be in this position. And the number of people I keep running into all over town living in their vehicle is growing. We really need to rethink society and decide if we should continue to put economics above humanity, he says. And William, I'm so sorry to hear that you're in this position. We want to hear from the community right now as we speak with Jeff Tucker, economist at Zillow, about the housing crisis that could become acute this week if rent relief isn't forthcoming for millions of Americans. Let us know your situation out there. It's 549-2937. Marlene in Jacksonville. Marlene, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have received one $600 check. That is all. People keep talking about these weekly $600 checks. No, I have had only one. And all of the rental pop-ups I see on my phone, Zillow and the other one. Forgot it.
Yeah, there's a few others, but yeah, go ahead.
They say you must earn three times what the rent is, and you must have a credit score of this or that, and first and last month's rent. Well, gee whiz, that's $5,000, $6,000 just to move. And from a place where I'm paying $1,400 for a 2-2, I'm sure I can get, I mean, I know I can get a less expensive 2-2, two-bedroom, two-bath. I'm on the south side, gated hell, as we fondly call it. But
Are you renting your two-bedroom, two-bath apartment?
I am, and I am unemployed. I'm looking for a job every minute.
Right. And what were you doing before the pandemic hit? Did you lose your job in the pandemic?
Not exactly, to be truthful, but it was coming anyway. I worked for a magazine whose name shall not be spoken.
Okay.
And copy editor for 17 years. But I'm an excellent editor, and if anybody needs one.
Sure. But Marlene, your main concern right now is how are you going to pay your rent, right? Obviously.
I don't know. And I've spoken to the people up front, and they've got their bills to pay too. I understand that. You know, they're fine human beings. I don't know what anyone's going to do. I just want to know where all my $600 checks are.
Right. You've only received one. And how long ago did you apply to receive that unemployment relief?
March.
And you've gotten one. All right, Marlene. Stay on the line.
And they asked. They said that they would be coming along. Just be patient. I'm thinking, really, really. So.
All right. We're going to grab your phone number, Marlene. I'm going to put you on hold so we can get that from you. And Jeff, you know, Marlene's typical for Jacksonville, as your research at Zillow finds. Zillow reports the typical rent payment in Jacksonville is $1,419 a month. the rent is just too high to begin with. Okay. We have a huge problem with affordable housing in this country. But when you hear someone like Marlene talk about her situation, this is so common, isn't it? You're seeing this replicated across America.
Absolutely. And actually that, yeah, that sounds like an incredibly challenging situation. And that's starting out from a place where renters are already going to have a lot of trouble saving up, stocking money away if they're paying, over 30% of, really, that's the rule of thumb. We've been talking here about how many people have to pay more than half their income on rent. But for the typical renter income in Jacksonville, which is $55,000 a year, that typical rent is a little over 30% of all of their pre-tax income. So that's already at a level that's making it difficult. And so that doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room if people lose their income, even for a few months, and certainly if they're unemployed all year. So there are projections now that we're going to have double-digit employment, perhaps through the end of the year. And in fact, I've seen some studies showing that if we allow this unemployment assistance to expire, the unemployment rate will be significantly higher at the end of the year. So that it strikes me that there's not actually even a trade-off there necessarily between sort of the humanitarian interest and the economic interest. And the reason that is that all of this rental assistance unemployment assistance going into people's pockets, they're not just sort of padding their mattress with it and, socking it away. They're spending it. There's a very high propensity to consume when you look at the rate that unemployed people actually spend their benefits. And so what that does is that sort of primes the pump in the rest of the economy. Their spending is everybody else's income. And so if you cut that off, then you get a vicious cycle where all of the places where they shop for groceries, their landlord, their car payments, all those other payments are not going out. And then that a whole lot of people who are employed are now seeing their incomes drop as well if we let this unemployment benefit expire.
You know, this is critical for millions, but as we heard from Marlene just now, she applied months ago and she's only received one check. And now the pressure is on the Senate to act quickly to provide relief. But there's not a lot of confidence that they can do this efficiently and get relief to struggling Americans in a timely manner. What about that problem?
That's a major problem. That's been a huge hang-up with the way that this program was rolled out. The state unemployment programs were just not designed to provide this sort of mass flood of checks and this sort of massive flood of analysis of people's unemployment applications. I've been saying that the when you look at the scale of initial unemployment claims, even now, even at the end of July, we're seeing well over a million new unemployment claims per week. Previously, in the worst recessions in the past, in sort of living memory, the Volcker recession in the early 1980s or in 2008, 2009. Previously, the worst ever week was near 700,000 unemployment claims. So even today, we're seeing almost twice that amount every single week coming in. So these unemployment offices are absolutely flooded with claims, and they're really struggling to keep up. They just weren't designed to be processing this many claims.
Yeah.
And I know that's very cold comfort to someone who really needs that check, but I think it's sort of a reflection of what's going on behind the scenes is that these are sort of administrative offices that were sort of tapped on the shoulder at the beginning of this crisis and said, hey, you know what? It's you're the front line for the entire country's government to sort of help all these people out. And they really were not prepared.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Here's an email from a listener to let Marlene know, if you're still listening, Marlene. Both federal and state unemployment must be reapplied for every 2 weeks. You've got to upload info related to at least 5 legitimate job applications applied for each of the 2 weeks with employers' names, type of job, specific job titles, phone numbers, and either websites or physical address. And so if you're still listening, Marlene, that may be something that will be of help to you. Maybe you've already been doing that. But let's take a few more calls. 549-2937, Rhea in Palatka. Rhea, good morning. Hi, Rhea, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just think that, like, the in response to the earlier Republican who said that we needed to get a handle on keeping America open or else we were going to have a famine, I just think this type of thinking is wrong. It's partisan, it's political, it's isolationalism. And if we looked at how other countries have contained it, two-hour tests, we don't even have tests, much less two-hour tests. I think we need to get serious and put aside our politics and get our heads down and contain the virus.
Rhea, you're absolutely right. We can't move forward economically if that isn't done. And it is simply a fact that the federal response has been a complete failure, leaving the states to try to muddle through on their own. Jeff, this is driving everything. The poor federal response to the coronavirus pandemic. It's why we are talking about this housing crisis right now.
Well, absolutely. The reason these benefits were set to expire this week is that this bill was passed and they went into effect in March. So it's been 4 months, and I don't think anybody back in March, even the pessimistic outcome back then was expecting maybe a second wave in the fall. But it turned out we seem to have gotten, you know, we never quite finished off the first wave of the pandemic, and now that it's resurged tremendously, especially across the South, to be honest, compared to sort of the Northeast and the West Coast in the early part. So this whole idea that the benefits should expire was premised on the idea that we would have a good handle on the pandemic. So I think even sort of by the logic of the original legislation, given that we absolutely do not have a handle on the pandemic, we now have more infections per week than we did when the legislation was passed. I think that's a pretty straightforward argument of that, hey, we didn't get it done in these 4 months. Let's try to extend it and figure it out a little bit in the future. And that's an interesting point about it not being a partisan issue. You know, if you look at Europe, you have Germany with a fairly conservative government. You have other countries with fairly liberal governments. People's health is a pretty nonpartisan issue, I think, and the sort of it's technical and public health initiatives necessary to stop the virus seem quite possible across party lines when you look internationally.
Bill in Arlington. Hi, Bill. Good morning. Happy Monday. Go ahead. Hey, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a couple of thoughts. So one is that I'm entirely in favor of the $600 a month extension of the benefits for unemployment. I mean, it's the only thing that's kept the government, it's the only thing that kept the country alive. I mean, just stripping the shells of everything so people have money. And so I'm in favor of that. I think the first plan, the first $3 trillion was the perfect solution to keep us going. But on the, as far as the renters are concerned and the $600 federal unemployment, most of the renters that I'm, or the landlords that I know, are not getting paid because the renters know they can't be evicted. So they're not using the $600 to pay their rent. They're using it to do other things with. It's been my experience now. I've canvassed the whole city, but my son has two units, and since March he hasn't been able to get paid for any of them, and he's not a rich man. So that's one point. And then the second one is that as far as the Congress is concerned, and particularly the Senate, and the $1 trillion versus the $3 trillion, and extending the unemployment. I was just thinking about in an election sequence or an election thing that homeless people, that's another way to suppress the vote. Now, that's just my own little thought, but I know it's really hard for homeless people to go and vote, and we got a vote coming up, and if this thing can be extended out beyond November, that would be definitely a way to suppress the vote. That's all I have.
Bill, thank you. Jeff, what about the position of landlords getting to his first point in this crisis?
Yeah, well, Florida's eviction moratorium, as I understand it, is going to expire this week. So to the extent that has perhaps enabled some renters to be able to stay in their units while in non-payment. That is expiring too, and I do think that is sort of another really important kind of policy cliff here, where there's a really sudden sharp difference in the way the rules are being applied. I would just also sort of point out that when we look at the numbers nationwide, the share of renters who have paid their rent in full, say for the month of June, now that we sort of have all the data looking back, was almost the same in 2020 as it was in 2019. The National Multifamily Housing Council tracks this. They are the sort of advocacy group of landlords. So this is their own data. It was 95.9% versus last year, 96%. We did see that start to slip a bit when you look at just how many people halfway through July had paid. It was down a couple percentage points compared to last July. So it seems like up through those first 3 months of the pandemic, probably thanks in large part to these boosted benefits, by and large, renters were still making making those full payments. Mm. I'm absolutely sure there are exceptions, and I think that gets back to this point that if we get to the stage where a lot of renters are not paying, if you're a landlord and you have to evict someone right now, or you choose to, you're going to have a hard time filling that vacancy as well. So, a vacant unit is also going to pay no rent. So that gets back to this point that when people can pay their rent, that is sort of providing income and economic activity for everybody else in the economy as well.
That's a great point. We'll continue to follow this. And I want to thank you so much, Jeff Tucker, economist at Zillow, with new information about the rental and housing crisis in our area. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Much more still ahead, meanwhile. Still ahead, we'll tell you why Edward Waters College is doing its part in this pandemic, telling its students, "We got you." We'll explain. But up next,
pray for everybody, because we're praying. That's the only way we're going to get through this crisis. Oh, this is horrific.
Home health agencies on the front lines of the pandemic. That's in a moment.
Citizens Property Insurance. Whether recovering or preparing, Citizens is available. Claims can be tracked at citizensfla.com or reported by calling a live Citizens rep 24/7.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Snap judgment means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until the story is over. Join me, Glenn Washington, for Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, we've heard a lot about the stress on local hospitals in the pandemic, but guess what? Home health agencies are feeling it too. These companies send care workers into homes to help with prescriptions, bathing, cleaning, light meals, everything somebody at home who is sick needs. And they're dealing not only with lots of sick patients, but also sick staffers. I spoke about it with Charlene Austin. She's the owner of AHP Home Healthcare in Jacksonville. She has 5 employees out sick with coronavirus. Here's her story. Charlene, good to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you.
Tell me what you're experiencing and what your staff is seeing out there with COVID patients.
I guess around, what is July, June, we started to see an increase of our COVID patients. The elderly people are more afraid of people coming inside their home. So they kind of refuse care.
you know, it's just vital that we go in and provide these services because most of them don't have family. I had a great concern for them and tried to talk to them and soothe them through the crisis. But now we're seeing an increase in the COVID cases with the patients as well as with the AIDS going in to the homes, and I guess people, other people coming inside their homes, their family members, bringing it to them, and then the AIDS going in, getting it from them, or the AIDS taking it in to them. But we're seeing more cases. In the last week, I had 5 people to go out.
Now, let me ask you this. We're hearing that hospitals are sending more COVID patients home and trying to monitor them from home.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that are you seeing?
Well, because my staff is down, and I usually have 21 employees, I haven't been able to accept any new COVID clients because I don't have the staff to. But every day I get 3, 4, 5 calls a day for new patients. So they're sending the people home because really there's nothing you can do for them except for make them comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that they're sending patients home that should honestly be in the hospital or not?
Well, from what I understand, they keep them in there for a period of time, and then once they break the fever or they get a little better, then they get them out of there pretty quick.
Yeah, that's what we've been hearing, just because they don't have a lot of bed space, right?
Right, right.
Well, what else are you hearing?
I'm hearing that it's going to get worse. And actually, I'm more afraid for my staff than anything because, you know, when you go into some of the homes, you just don't know what you're walking into. We serve the elderly. A lot of our patients, well, the majority of my patients are over 70 years old. And they got grandchildren, and they're coming in and out, and that's the caring age right now. We're walking into the danger zone.
Yeah. So how are you dealing with that? How are your employees dealing with that?
Well, I've ordered PPE, and I can say one thing about Humana. They were very expeditious about sending us, they sent me gowns, face masks, and gloves. So I put together a packet for each one of them and asked them to please, you know, when you go in, just be suited up. You got to take it seriously.
Yeah.
You got to cover yourself and make sure that you have your mask and your gown on when you come out before you get in your car. Take it, discard it, put it in a plastic bag, put it in the trunk of your car, and dispose of it in the garbage can before you go into your homes or whatever. But it's just so serious.
Yeah, it really is. Well, I really hope your staff manages and you as well through this crisis. And I want to thank you for talking with us.
Okay, you're welcome. And pray for everybody because we're praying. I think that's the only way we're going to get through this crisis. Oh, this is horrific.
And that was Charlene Austin we just heard from. She's the owner of AHP Home Healthcare in Jacksonville. Well, here's some good news to share. Edward Waters College is helping its students right now by paying their tuition. Yes, and they're also helping with other fees. This campaign is called We Got You. EWC President Dr. Zachary Faison Jr. is on the line. Dr. Faison, good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm great, thanks. And it's good to hear your voice. So big news for your students. You're easing the financial burden of returning students and their parents for the upcoming academic year. You're really going to pay the balances of all returning students' tuition and fees, room and board, and activity fees, right?
Yes, we are really going to do that. We were excited to be able to make that announcement just a little while ago that for every returning Edward Waters College student, you know, Melissa, often for our students, we serve a population of students that are about nearly 90% Pell eligible. I mean, they coming from very economically disadvantaged backgrounds. And every year, it seems, you know, there's a certain amount that we charge in tuition and fees and room and board. And although we're the most affordable private institution in the state of Florida, there still exists that gap between, you know, the amount that students can get with their financial aid and all the financial support that they can get, and then the cost of attendance. So what EWC is committed to doing this year is standing in that proverbial gap for those students. So for every returning Edward Waters College student for this upcoming fall and spring semester, EWC is going to step in and pay that balance, pay that difference between what their financial aid packages are and what the cost of attendance is. So it's around approximately about $3,000 for the average student, but that can range up to, you know, $5,000, $7,000, $8,000, just depending upon how much financial aid that particular student can get. So
okay.
This is a commitment that we wanted to really make to our students and parents, especially given these hard times that everyone's facing navigating the pandemic.
How many students total will receive this benefit?
So all of our returning students that were enrolled in the spring are eligible. We don't know, of course, how many of them are going to come back, but we're wanting to encourage them to come back. And if they don't come back, we don't want it to be because they didn't have the financial wherewithal to do so. So that's our commitment. That's our commitment. So we're hopeful. We had probably about a little over 700 students after we had commencement and graduation last year that were eligible to return to the institution. So we're hopeful. But all 700 of them, or approximately 700 of them, will take advantage of this.
Sure.
So we're hopeful, and we wanted to do everything that we could to incentivize them continuing their programs of study.
And when class begins, will EWC welcome kids physically back to campus, or will it be all virtual learning?
Well, we're actually kind of moving to a hybrid model. We've given parents and students the choice. So we are going to be having some students are going to elect to come back to the campus physically. You know, Melissa, what we did was we took a survey over the summer of our student body, and approximately 80% of those students said that, frankly, they kind of loathed the virtual experience. They wanted the opportunity to come back and have face-to-face interactions with their faculty. And so we're going to be offering students that option. Some students and parents will elect to stay home, and that's okay. We're going to continue our virtual instruction as well. So we've given the students and their parents the opportunity to choose. But even though we do have some students coming back, we have, you know, taken a number of precautionary measures to ensure as best we possibly can their health and safety for this upcoming year.
So for the students who do return, what will class and campus life look like? What restrictions will be in place?
So it'll be a lot different. So for one, we're moving in our residence halls to single occupancy only. So there used to be a time, as you may know, that you'd have a roommate, you may even have three to a room. Well, we just don't think that's prudent given this environment. So every EWC student now will be assigned a single room. In all of our classroom spaces, we're doing physical distancing, 6 feet apart. So we're going to be spacing our classroom spaces out such that we can maintain proper distance. We also are providing PPE to all of our faculty, staff, and students. That's disposable masks. We actually have prepared PPE kits that we'll be issuing to every faculty and staff and student at the institution. And we'll be kind of replenishing those as we go through the academic year. They'll have disposable masks. They'll have a cloth mask. They'll have gloves. They'll have sanitizer. We also have significantly upgraded our cleaning protocols in terms of frequency and depth of cleaning in all of our resident facilities, our academic and non-academic buildings. So it really has been a comprehensive effort. We actually enlisted a task force back in late May that we call our Campus Operations Reengineering Task Force that had our students, faculty, staff, administrators on it. And they did much of the work to develop what this new normal would look like for EWC coming up in the fall. So we are preparing to welcome many of our students back.
And let me ask you as well, Dr. Faison, Florida's oldest historically black college, EWC, is in the process of becoming a university. That's exciting news as well. Tell us about the next phase for this development.
Yes, we're extremely excited about that. It's been a long time coming. You know, one of the things that was really an aspirant vision for this administration, we came on about 2 years ago. We kind of took a pulse, took a survey, and did some listening sessions with our faculty, staff, students, also hearing, of course, from our Board of Trustees about what the institution aspires to be 5 years or 10 years. And one of the things that was divulged was that we wanted to be able to move to becoming a university. And so recently, there have been some very positive developments that we believe are going to buttress us to be able to make that aspirant dream a reality, one of which is that UWC for some years had been suffering through some financial difficulties, some operational debt. We had run about 12 years consecutively having some operational debt. We're able to end this fiscal year that just passed June 30th with a seven-figure operational surplus.
And is that how you're able to carry the tuition payments for the student body?
That's a part of it. It certainly is a part of it. You know, getting our financial house in order, getting us fiscally stronger certainly helped us to be able to do that. And then you combine that with the recent announcement of the additional $3.5 million that will be forthcoming from the state legislature that went to EWC. And the combination of those two things really are helping us to be able to provide more assistance to our students, and then also, as you alluded to earlier, for us to be able to really begin to expand our curriculum. And so one of the things, again, that we have as a goal is to be able to offer our first graduate degree program. And so right now, prospectively, we're looking at offering our first master's degree program in business administration. So there's a process that you have to go through for that. That didn't happen overnight, but the most prodigious challenge usually is the funding. And so now that we have funding in place, we'll be able to begin to aggressively pursue that. And we're also going to be expanding our undergraduate program offerings. We're looking at offering new programs in social work, in forensic science, in computer and information science. So this really, really is a real transformative time for the institution right now.
It really is. And I want to thank you for all the updates. He is EWC President Zachary Faison Jr. as the school is paying the tuition and fees for its students in this upcoming academic year and also in the process of becoming a university. Dr. Faison, thanks for hopping onto the show this morning, and keep in touch, okay?
Thanks so much for having me. Good to hear your voice. Have a great day.
You as well. You as well. Just a periodic reminder, all of our guests for the time being are either on the phone or on Google Hangout as we continue to socially distance here at WJCT in this pandemic. There are only a few staffers here in the building each day, myself and the show staff, along with just a few others in the newsroom. Up next, how Native Son is helping local restaurants during the pandemic. We'll speak with owner Aaron Gottlieb about how they're doing their part. That's right after this.
Farah and Farah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farahandfarah.com or 396-5555. Farah and Farah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good. Storm season is here, and JEA is doing everything possible to prepare. And you can too, by updating your contact information and signing up for alerts. You can stay up to date on power restoration efforts. Update your contact info today at JEA.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Mike Birbiglia, writer, actor, performer, and contributor to This American Life. His latest book, The New One, is about reluctantly becoming a father and what it felt like to not feel immediately bonded to his daughter. We'll also hear from his wife, who tells her side of the story in poems included in the book. Join us.
Today at noon, here on WJCT News 89.9.
For some small business owners, the extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits was a relief.
My first initial response was go ahead and take it because this is extra support for you because I don't know when I will be able to rehire you back.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How those business owners are feeling now that those benefits are going away. The story next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 here on WJCT News 89.9.
The president's doubling down on his law and order message ahead of the election. But for some, using federal agents to police dissenters isn't just unwelcome. It's behavior you'd expect from a fascist dictator. So it's time we talked about that F word, what it means, and whether such comparisons are accurate. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the beloved local grocery store Native Son Natural Foods Market reopened its Beaches location earlier this year after shutting down last summer. It was a bright spot in all of the news about businesses closing. And now Native Son is doing what it can to support local food producers and restaurants in this pandemic. Aaron Gottlieb, Native Son owner, is on the line. Hi, Aaron. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's so good to have you on the show, and it was exciting to see you reopening at the Beaches earlier this year. And so you're trying to pay forward the culinary community. What are you doing right now? What are you working on?
Well, you know, ironically, I actually went to our roots about what happened to Native Son. We were facing fierce competition over the past 5 years in the grocery market. Jacksonville became ground zero for chains, new chains opening up. And so when I reflected about after Native Son was forced to close due to the competition, I go, what was one of the things that I wished I would have done? And Jacksonville, being a very spread out community, has a lot to offer, but not everybody can access it. And instead of trying to be something for everybody, I decided that our Beaches location, when I had the opportunity to reopen it, that what I should do is bring everything great about Jacksonville to one place. So rather than spread myself too thin, really help others. And that was my game plan before I knew COVID was going to be coming our way and affecting our community and really the world.
Okay, so then in having a niche approach, what does that mean? When someone steps inside your store, what are they going to experience that's different?
Well, first and foremost, we've done a couple of things that we thought was important, and first was safety. And so we started with the concept of a friend of mine is in the technology business, and he started a concept of touchless aisles. And it gave our customers the ability to take their phones and take their cameras out, and without downloading an app, just scan over a top-selling product, and it will give the nutritional data and the ingredient list. And we did that with safety all the way through, whether it was first in the city to decide plexiglass and masks were the right thing. But what you see different is there, even though COVID's affected us, there's normalcy. When people come in here, they still feel cared about. They still feel like we're paying attention to their needs, and we're not just trying to make ends meet. And in doing so, it gave us the opportunity to look outside of who Native Son is and going, what does the community need? And restaurants, it started off with one or two, but it ended up blossoming to where when you come into Native Son now and you go to our food service, instead of it just being focused on us, it's changed its focus to where you see 80% of our food selection are from local area restaurants, and only 20% really is the foods that we're creating. So we have a chance to make our foods the best they've ever been while we're highlighting great companies and really showcasing what the city needs to protect. These restaurants need to be here when COVID has settled down and we all start going back to a normal life.
That's right. Let me give a shout out to all of your restaurant and artisan partners. Bethesda Farms, they make local eggs. Community Loaves in Murray Hill, amazing organic bread. Delicombe, which does sauerkraut. Fit Fab Foods, cake pops and whoopie pies. Excellent. Leaf and Bean, an amazing vegetarian restaurant in the area. Prati Italia, they're giving you pizza kits and other delicious things. Present Moment, raw food. Shakti, raw food tacos and other things. Southern Roots, a great selection of stuff there. Sweet Theory, they do vegan biscuits. And Wainwright Dairy, those are your partners that you are really trying to support in this crisis. Yes?
Those are not just our partners. Here's the irony. When Native Son was in the competitive grocery market, and that was our focus, because that's what we thought our customers wanted, what we found was some of these partners that we dealt with in the old version of what we were bubbling to the top of our top-rated brands in our company. And shockingly and excitedly, this is happening again. Shakti, a raw foods company that most people in town are familiar with, the parent company, European Street, which is associated by the family and the kitchen being used. They are a top five brand in our store and have been in our old world and in the reopening. But then you have, as you brought up, Fit Fab Foods with cake pops and whoopie pies. They brought us these products, and we did not know that they were going to be such a big hit. We put them on the shelves, and they've hit our top 10 brands. And so these brands are really defining not just Native Son, but the city and what the city has to offer. So it's just the beginning for us. We are looking to partner with high-quality brands that focus on clean ingredients. And it's a real hustle. I mean, these brands don't have wholesale. A lot of them don't have wholesale experience.
Yeah.
So it's up to us to learn and teach
What leadership you're showing. So I just want to give the shout out. If you've never been to Native Son Natural Foods Market, they're in the 1500 block of 3rd Street in Jacksonville Beach, right across from the Metro Diner. You can make one stop at Native Son and enjoy all of the deliciousness of the community while minimizing your outings. One stop there and you can support so many great local restaurants and food artisans. And I want to thank you so much, Aaron Gottlieb, owner of Native Son. Thanks for joining us, and I'll be stopping by soon and check all this out. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Again, Native Son in Jacks Beach. Check them out. You're supporting a locally owned business and a lot of other locally owned businesses when you food shop there. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Stay safe, have a great week, and keep wearing your masks, please.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.